Get ready to jump off Zod. We're going to get you with the hard count.
Come on!
Hosted by two guys who babble more than Manning at the line of scrimmage.
Red, right, orange, purple!
Here's Aaron Nagler.
Don't shut me up!
And Andrew Garda.
I'm friggin' velvety smooth.
And here we go.
Here we go again, another edition of the Hard Count. Neither earthquake, nor hurricane, nor blackout will keep us from our appointed rounds, but apparently a fantasy football draft will make us change nights. That's right, I'm Andrew Garda. This is Tuesday night. Normally, of course, you guys know I tape it on Wednesday for Thursday. Little change in plans. I have my last fantasy football league draft Wednesday night. So rather than try and cram this in here at the same time or after and get, like, no sleep, I decided I'd do it Tuesday night. And you guys have yourselves a little surprise on Wednesday. We got a lot of stuff to cover tonight. We're going to head to Philadelphia, talk about Michael Vick's ka-ching, straight cash homie, giant-sized contract, what it means, what it is, and what it really isn't. Then we are going to head over to the Jets-Giants game, talk a little bit about rookie Muhammad Wilkerson's ejection, pseudo-ejection, since both he and Brandon Jacobs didn't actually leave the sideline like they're supposed to. And then we are going to go a little bit around the league, talk about what we saw at the end of the preseason here, and the second-to-last game, the penultimate game, as it were. We're also going to talk about breaking news, which is Frank Gore's brand spanking new contract extension. So all of that and more tonight on the Hard Count. As has been the case lately, Mr. Aaron Nagler is not here with us. He is off on vacation, a little vacay before the NFL season hits. And so I'm flowing solo tonight, and that's fine. I want to remind you guys, you can check out my latest From the Press Box, the Tuesday article that I do at CheeseheadTV.com, talking about some of the events of the past weekend and week. And a reminder that this Thursday, we will have another in my series of 10 questions with, this time with Chris Hansen of the Raiders blog. Talk a little Oakland Raiders football, the silver and black, Al Davis, and all the nuttiness that goes on in Oakland. So definitely check back on Thursday for that article. Chris has some great information. He's already given me his answers to the 10 questions, so I can assure you it's going to be an interesting article, as always. And of course, you can check out the last couple, which include Alfie Crow, Jacksonville Jaguars writer at BigCatCountry.com, and of course, the LA Times own Sam Farmer, NFL analyst. And, you know, I'd be remiss in not mentioning a recent departure of someone in the media, and that would be Tom Killer Kowalski, Detroit Lions blogger, writer, really, beat writer for more than a decade, I think a couple of decades, passed away Monday morning at the way too young age of 51. I never had the delight of meeting Kowalski in person. We exchanged tweets a couple times, and by all accounts, he was a very, very good guy, very generous with his time and very generous with his wisdom and wit. And, you know, I certainly enjoyed his writing, and he was a guy who I went to anytime I felt like I needed to know what was going on with the Lions. And Lord knows there were a lot of times when you want to know what's going on with the Lions. So, Tom Kowalski passed away at the age of 51. Of course, everyone here at Cheesehead TV and the Hard Count want to extend their condolences to his family and friends. It is a tough loss. The media, the NFL writers, all of us are a little bit poorer for his passing. He was a fantastic writer, and we will probably not see his like for some time. So I just kind of wanted to get that out of the way. And with that, let's move on to a couple of other things. First on our list, of course, is Mike Vick. Michael Vick, who just signed himself a ginormous $100 million, six-year, supposedly $40 million guaranteed contract with the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, I'll talk about my overall feelings as to whether this was a wise choice by the Eagles and my concerns with it. But let's look at the deal itself. And Mike Florio over at ProFootballTalk.com did a great job of going over the Mike Vick contract details. This six-year, $100 million contract, $40 million guaranteed, is actually really a five-year, $80 million deal. Because if Vick participates in 35% or more of the snaps in any year of the deal, then that 6 year is voided. We know that's going to happen. Even if he gets hurt the usual two games, it's going to be more than 35%. Barring a spectacular injury every single year, he's going to have that 6 year voided. It probably protects Vic from, you know, being suddenly finding himself underpaid, if that's possible. Beyond that, $32.5 million is fully guaranteed, and $3 million is guaranteed, but only for injury. So if he gets hurt, that's when he gets that $3 million. So the total guaranteed is $35.5 million, which is less than that $40 million that was actually reported at first. He can earn another $3 million in bonuses if the Eagles win a Super Bowl in 2011 or 2012, and then if he participates in 77.5% of the plays during the regular season, which, given Vic, is a little bit more dicey, but not completely out of the realm of the possibility. The Super Bowl, neither here nor there, that 77.5% is not out of his reach. So under the five-year deal, he'll make, according to Mike Florio, who looked at the deal, $20 million in 2011, $12.5 million in 2012, $15.5 million in 2013, $15.5 million in 2014, and $16.5 in 2015. It's still a tremendous amount of money, and still about, you know, $45, $50 million over the next 3 years. But that $100 million is unlikely to actually come to fruition because, you know, there's no way that Vic will never, you know, take more than 35% of those snaps, because they're going to cut him if he does that. So that it's not really a six-year deal, which is one of those things with contracts in the NFL that you always just scratch your head at. I mean, why bother with the six-year deal? I mean, I'm not sure who that benefits. I mean, it benefits the Eagles kind of because they have an out on that six if he underperforms, but it doesn't really benefit them because if he's less than 35% snaps for the entirety of the contract, it's a waste of money and they're going to cut him anyway and be out, you know, 35.5 guaranteed. And what does it really do for Vic? I guess it negates that 6 year because it's definitely going to negate it. But I don't really understand why bother putting that 6 year in there. It's not going to happen. That 6 year isn't going to happen. It's like a weird, I don't even know what it is. It's like being kind of pregnant. Either you are or you aren't. Either this is a five-year deal or a six-year deal. And, you know, frankly, it's a five-year deal. So just call it what it is. I don't understand why Vic wanted a six-year deal or okayed a six-year deal. And I don't know why the Eagles bothered with a six-year deal when we both know that that six-year is a complete lie. It's a fabrication. I don't understand that 6 year. I don't understand why anybody wanted it in there. I mean, I don't understand why Vic wanted it in there, because it's clear by that out clause that he doesn't want the 6 year, that somebody in his camp doesn't want that 6 year so he can go be a free agent or whatever. And the Eagles can't really want that 6 year because 35% of the snaps is retarded low for 6 years, for 5 years, really, because the 6 years, the one we're talking about being gotten rid of. On top of that, according to Florio, Vic's $20 million compensation for the 2011 season comes from a $7 million signing bonus, a $10 million guaranteed base salary, and a $3 million roster bonus, which means his cap is at $14.4 million, and that actually created room for the team. So if for some reason the Eagles need to hire someone else, pick up another player, they have a little more cap room now. Next year, he earns $12.5 million, and his cap number actually goes down to 13.9. And in 2013, he's making 16.5 with a $1 million de-escalator, which would probably make it a $15.5 million. But nobody really knows why or how that escalator or de-escalator happens. And the $3 million of the money is guaranteed. The cap number is at 16.9, so it actually goes up. So it's an interesting deal. There are a couple aspects of it I don't get. And here's another thing I really don't get. All right, Michael Vick had a fantastic season last year. He kind of faded a little at the end. But for the most part, Vick played beyond, I think, what anybody expected. I think even people who were big Vick backers were caught a little bit unsurprised, or they were surprised, because nobody expected him to have the year he did last year. What's amazing, and, you know, looking at this also from a fantasy football standpoint, people expect him to have this miracle season again, and many fantasy football owners are taking him in the first round, which means they're betting on it. That's your season. If Vic goes down for a couple games at the wrong time, you could be in some trouble. It's less of a risk in a best ball, which means all players at once league. It's more of a problem in head-to-head. But I digress. It's not a fantasy football show, but it is something that I've noticed. And overall, there's a fair amount of people who believe that Vic is just automatically going to be able to do this. This is with a mediocre offensive line that is rife with youngsters who are still learning the game. This is with a defense that has a huge hole in the middle of it. And teams will run and grind the clock out to keep Vic off the field. This is with a quarterback whose running style opens him up to huge hits. Like we saw the other day in Philadelphia's last game. When he was out there running around, and Cleveland, of all teams, was out there pounding on him. He took a lot of heavy hits from Cleveland. So you have an injury risk quarterback with a shaky offensive line and a questionable defense up the middle. And you're paying him, well, not $100 million, because we just talked about how it's not $100 million, but $80 million over 5 years. Now, he was franchised, or was going to be franchised this year. They kind of needed to make a deal by middle of September to lock him in. So maybe the Eagles felt like they were backed into a corner. But, and credit where credit is due, fellow football guy, Sigmund Bloom put it best when the deal came up, which is like, did you really see enough in the preseason to justify this contract? I mean, it hasn't looked good in the preseason. He's had those flashes of greatness, but he's also had his flashes of sort of mediocrity and poor play, which is how Michael Vick's career is gone. His highs are higher than almost anyone in the league, but his lows are bargain basement. He could be fantastic and a train wreck, all in the same, I would almost say the same play. Certainly the same game. Definitely the same season. So, I mean, we even saw it at the end of last season, sort of faded a little bit. So you're giving Michael Vick all of this money, and it's not an unreasonable contract at all when you break down the numbers per year. But you're giving this guy this money and a lot of guaranteed cash. And there's all this risk attached to it. And it's not unlike to me the guys who are taking him early in a fantasy football league. And it's a risk that I just wouldn't take on. And won't from a fantasy standpoint. I don't know that I'd want to take it on long term, with an NFL standpoint. You figure he has 2 to 3 more years if he continues to play at the level he did in 2010. He probably has 2 to 3 more years of that. Could be longer, but his game relies on athleticism so much in a way that a guy like Manning's doesn't. Manning is more of a pocket passer, so I think he'll survive longer. But Vic, and this is not denigrating his ability. But when your game is predicated on speed to some extent and mobility, as you get older, you just get less mobile. It just happens. So at some point, he's going to fade, and I think it's going to happen 2-3 years from now. So, you know, you've got another couple of years beyond that where you're looking at paying this guy a lot of money for being mediocre. Now, I don't know, maybe he has 5 more fantastic years left in him. It just seems to me to be a huge risk. And on a side note, by the way, listen, what Michael Vick did with the dogfighting was horrific, terrible, horrifying, and unconscionable. Is it as bad as, say, Dante Stallworth running over a guy, Leon Little? No. Taking a human life, taking a dog life, they're not equitable. However, what he did was horrible. That said, the man served his time. And I have no problem with him making this money. I'm not horrified by it. I'm not offended by it. And there are a fair amount of people who are. Good for him. He had what Cecil Lammy and Sigmund Bloom call a near-career death experience. Like, he did something horrible. He paid for doing something horrible. In some respects, Munn might argue that he paid more than your average person might have because he was so high profile. He did his time. He came back. He's earned his place in the league, and he has earned that money. I mean, like I said, I wouldn't have paid him that money, but not because of what he did off the field. But he worked hard. And if someone offered him that contract, I'm fine with him taking it. And I'm fine with, you know, I don't agree with giving him the money, but not because of what he's done off the field. It's because I have questions on the field. By the same token, I didn't get into it with people last night, but it definitely was a discussion back and forth. God didn't give Michael Vick this money. Praising God for him getting this cash. If God was giving out millions of dollars, it would probably go to sick kids and poor people. At least any God I believe or know about. Like, I don't think he gives professional athletes money any more than he or she decides who's going to win a game. You know, God doesn't like the team that lost less. So I just kind of want to throw that out there as well. Feel free to discuss amongst yourselves. But last I knew, there were a lot of sick people and poor people who needed money more than Michael Vick. I won't say we're more deserving of them because I can't say that. But I will say that praising God for that, it goes in the same file as the people who praise, you know, God led me to this victory on the football field. No, God didn't. You did. And maybe you want to praise God for helping you find the strength inside to play as hard as you did. But God didn't win that game for you. God also didn't give Michael Vick that money. Michael Vick earned that money. But anyway, I digress. Suddenly we're political. I don't want to do that. Let's get off the politics. And let's talk about more contracts. Because there's nothing more fun in football than contracts. But there have, of course, been some very contentious contract discussions. Michael Vick's was not one. It was sort of a low flame discussion for a long time. We thought it might happen, but we didn't know whether it would or wouldn't. Chris Johnson, no new news on Chris Johnson, except for they are still far apart. And for Tennessee, the big concern is Javon Ringer, Johnson's backup, is on crutches. And they're a little worried of him. So you got Jamie Harper, a rookie, behind him. Harper's pretty good, but neither of them are Chris Johnson. And this seems like, you know, and I said it a week ago, I think this is going into the season. And I think that that is problematic on so many levels for the Titans. And I'm not going to guarantee it, but I think, I believe pretty strongly that Chris Johnson will end up hurt at some point early in the season. I'm sure he's working out like a bat out of hell, but I'll tell you what. So was Darrell Revis. So have been many other guys who have held out early in the season or missed all of preseason, and they have ended up hurt early. However, one contract that has finally been fulfilled has been the one between Frank Gore and the San Francisco 49ers, ProFootballTalk.com, again, and they're not a sponsor, I just keep going to the site, has reported that the Niners have agreed the terms with Frank Gore on a 3-year, $21 million extension. And this includes $13.5 million guaranteed. That's on top of Gore's $4.9 million salary for 2011. He could earn $25.9 million over 4 years. Now, of course, he didn't go out and test the open market, so he couldn't pull himself some Weddle cash and become Weddle rich like D'Angelo Williams did. But Gore got that last big contract as he hits age 28 and comes dangerously close to that age that says a running back may go downhill, which is the age of 30. So they, you know, we'll see how Gore, having missed some camp but not all camp, I mean, this contract didn't hold out or anything, so I think he should be okay. He's not quite as effective as he used to be in breaking tackles, not as effective as he used to be receiving the ball. Seemed to slow a little bit last season. You will see a little bit. I mean, I think that Jim Harbaugh will use rookie Kendall Hunter, a little bit more than his predecessors used backup running backs. Give Gore a little bit of break so that if San Francisco pulls it together, he has something in the tank for later in the year. I got to tell you, I don't know that San Francisco pulls anything together. I'm sorry. I like the Niners, but that team is a mess. The Alex Smith experiment continues, and Smith continues to catch fire, but in a totally bad way, where the catching fire means you're exploding and imploding on the field. Colin Kaepernick, as we knew, still a project. Going to take him a year or two to really get up to speed. There's just nothing going on there. Michael Crabtree needs surgery on his broken foot. He'll be back sometime early in the season. He may make week one. Josh Morgan, Braylon Edwards, not really impressing. It's just Vernon Davis, and I think it's going to be hard for Davis to carry the entire offense when Alex Smith is playing so poorly. The 49ers have problems. And it's great that they got Frank Gore signed, but here's a thought. Why don't you go take some money, head over to the free agency market, and find a free agent lineman or two. Maybe a center. A lot of ways to go. I'm not just saying, but I am just saying. I mean, the 49ers, and Aaron and I talked about it as far back as one of the first podcasts, the first episodes of the Hard Count. But the 49ers' offensive line was hanging by like a thin thread to begin with. And that thread snapped. They lost Boss to free agency. You know, they've lost the center to injury. It's not good. And they're not playing well. I don't think this is some grand plan for Harbaugh to get Andrew Luck out of Stanford. And, you know, as long as we're projecting, let's all take a minute when we talk about Luck being the number one overall pick to remember that Jake Locker this time last year was a lock to be the number one pick. Now, I didn't believe in Locker the way that I believe in Luck, and I see less problems with Luck's game than Locker's game. At this point last year, I didn't believe in Locker. I think he could be a decent quarterback, but I think it's going to take a while. He's got some accuracy issues, got a couple other issues. I don't have those problems with Luck. But we do know that a player can be at the height and then tumble. There's not much you could do about that. Projecting that far ahead is difficult. Difficult at best. Going into the college season, though, Luck is definitely someone you want to watch. But I don't know that Harbaugh is going to be trying to suck for Luck. This is the conversation I constantly have with people, too. Nobody's looking to lose. Nobody's trying to lose every game so they could get a player. because everybody in the NFL knows one single player does not make a franchise. And you, now you may point to, say, the Rams, who got Sam Bradford and turned things around pretty significantly last year. Let's look at a couple things. First of all, that division sucks. The NFC West is just a disaster area for the most part. Secondly, that offensive line always played under its ability, and it picked it up last year. Steven Jackson made a big difference. Jackson's been playing really well for a long time. Finally, he had someone to pull the defensive off him because Bradford could throw the ball, and Bradford had some extra success because you couldn't just sit there and hang back and try and pick off his passes because Steven Jackson would kill you on the ground. The defense played better. It's a team sport. Andrew Luck going to the San Francisco 49ers is not going to save that offensive line. It is not going to fix whatever is wrong with the defense, which plays so far below its talent level on paper that it's almost a tragedy. And it's not going to fix the wide receiver core, which is questionable at best right now. I mean, Michael Crabtree is very close to bust status. Like, you see that ability that he has, and he's one of those guys. I just feel like years from now, we're going to sit there and go, the hell happened to Crabtree? He had so much talent, and he wasted it. Really. I mean, there's so many things wrong with the Niners right now. I don't think that Harbaugh is looking at it and going, oh, man, if we can really just underplay this year, Andrew Luck comes and all's well. If he is, he's not going to last long in the NFL. You need to build through the draft, but you need picks to do it. But you also need more from the people you have there already. I had an interview this past weekend with Ryan Burns of footballsickness.com, and I went over my thoughts on the Jets for this season. So go over to footballsickness.com and check it out. And you know, we talked about how the Jets, they sort of are doing this really risky and difficult balancing act where they're building from the draft. You know, they get their Sean Green, they get Vlad Dukes, they get Mark Sanchez, they get, you know, this year they got Mo Wilkerson and Kenrick Ellis. You know, Jeremy Curley, Greg McElroy. You know, they're building through the draft, but they also pull in vets like a LaDainian Tomlinson last year, like Plaxico Burress and Derek Mason this year. And it's a tough balancing act because you've got age and experience, but less ability sometimes because Plax and Mason are not as fast as they used to be, and you could see that on display Monday night when they were having problems breaking away from the coverage. But at the same point, you're not totally in rebuilding mode because you're not just relying on, say, Bilal Powell to carry your offense or Sanchez to do it alone to try and break in, you know, brand new wide receivers fresh out of college. I think the 49ers have the ability on the team to be a solid team. It's up to Harbaugh and his staff to find a way to access that talent and make it translate into consistent play. And right now, and it's just preseason, I get it, but right now, they're not doing it. The 49ers are not off to a good start. Not at all. And let's be honest. That 30-7 drubbing at the hands of the Houston Texans, that doesn't help anything. And further, as long as we're talking about does preseason really matter, let's not get too geeked up about the Houston Texans. That said, if Arian Foster can stay healthy, you know, you've got Arian Foster on the ground, you've got Andre Johnson through the air, Matt Schaub thrown to an Ohm Daniels. I mean, this is a team that is loaded for bear. I don't want to, like, crown them, as Lovie Smith would say, or Denny Green, sorry, would say. But that's an impressive group of people right there. And they tore up the San Francisco 49ers. I mean, Ben Tate, 52 yards on the ground. Matt Leinart was throwing the ball well. You know, you look on the other side, Kaepernick, an interception, 52 yards. Alex Smith, an interception, and 17 yards. That's just not good. One sack later in the game, not even a starting unit sack. Meanwhile, you've got three sacks by the Houston unit. Connor Barwin, Tim Jamison, and Antonio Smith. And they were in the backfield the whole time. The whole time. So the Niners, a lot of work to do. Jim Harbaugh has a very tough row to hoe. We'll see if he'll be able to do it. See if he can correct things this weekend as we close in on the season. Now, even though it's mostly going to be fourth string, although if you're the San Francisco 49ers, I think you play your first string as much as you can because they're clearly not in sync. But any win at this point will feel like a good win for the San Francisco 49ers. I don't know if you watched Monday's game, and we talked a little bit about the Jets a minute ago, but I don't know if you watched that game, and if so, if you didn't need to use your no-dos that night, because the Giants-Jets game was a pretty big snore. A couple of interesting things, and I touched on this a little bit in my Tuesday column, so I'm not going to belabor it. But the Jets are really taking the dink and dunk thing pretty far. The Giants have a banged-up secondary. Jets barely challenged it. And Eli Manning is in mid-season inconsistent form. That was the Eli game. Great passes to Hakeem Nicks and complete confusion between him and Mario Manningham, Victor Cruz, just complete. Two passes that I don't think ever should have been thrown. One, maybe you give him the benefit of the doubt because he was about to be hit. That went for an interception. It sailed a little bit high. Tom Coughlin tried to blame it on a tan end, but I'm not buying it. That was just not a great throw. And then a horrific throw to Ahmad Bradshaw that had no business being thrown. I don't know if Manning did not see David Harris there or if he just didn't care. It was a good 5-6 yards short of where Bradshaw was. Bradshaw couldn't even make a play on that. I mean, it was awful. So Manning is in mid-season Manning form, or Eli form, because Manning form would be effectiveness, as Archie and Pepe will tell you. One interesting side note, and again, I touched on this a little bit from one direction in the from the press box column. That would be the brouhaha between Muhammad Wilkerson, rookie defensive end for the Jets, and veteran running back who should know better, Brandon Jacobs. Now, I talked a little bit about Jacobs. He should have known better, and he can't take those penalties. And that penalty cost his team a touchdown because he should have been in there for short yardage duty. And instead, it was Danny Ware who just couldn't get the job done. He's just not big enough and not strong enough to move the pile the way that Brandon Jacobs can. But I didn't talk about the other side of it, and there was an interesting article by Michael David Smith, again over Pro Football Talk, not a sponsor of Cheesehead TV, no matter what happens. And Wilkerson was interviewed, of course, on the ejection. And he was saying, you know, he basically came out and said, hey, it was not the smartest thing to get kicked out. I got to not get 15-yard penalties on my team, and I got in trouble for that. But he did say Jacob started it, and he's just not going to back down when someone starts something with him. Said, I was just pass rushing, and he came up to pass protect, and I ran into him the first time. The ball was thrown, and he approached me, threw a blow at me, and that's what it was. I retaliated. Was it smart? No. Do I regret it? No. It's football. I'm not going to let somebody try and take advantage of me. This is always interesting to me because this is the mentality of a football player. Yes, I was wrong to do it, but no, I am not going to regret it. Wilkerson talked about letting his anger get the best of him. Jacobs did the same thing. But it is a theme that I'm seeing among players to some extent when it comes to things that might be considered boneheaded moves. I mean, you start with a guy like James Harrison, who's literally calling out Commissioner Goodell for penalties against him and fellow Steelers. And then you have Domikon Sue, who, again, I talked a little bit about it today in the column, but, you know, has been out there saying, I'm not going to change my playing style. I don't think it's dirty. I don't think that I'm out to hurt anyone. Particularly the thing I was talking about today was about him and Mankins, the Patriots offensive lineman, getting into it. Mankins grabbed Lawrence Jackson's face mask, and Sue came to his teammate's aid, and Sue didn't get flagged for it. You may get, you know, financially dinged for it. But I'm definitely seeing a lot of players who have come out and been, this is how I play. This is the game of football. Let's go. And it's interesting to me because we talk a lot about player safety and we talk about players being adults and saying, hey, this is the game of football. There's some inherent risk in it. Let's go. You know, let's just play. Don't put flags on me. I just want to play the game, and I know that it's at risk. Now, I still say that we need to protect the players from themselves to some extent. But listen, you got Austin Colley, wide receiver for the Indianapolis Colts, with a special helmet that's lighter but more durable and can absorb impact better than anything most of the other guys are playing with. So Colley's saying, hey, listen, there's a risk. I'll take that risk, but you know what? I'm going to try and protect myself from this risk. And this is something I go back to in terms of player safety, which is kind of where all of these rules come from. There are very simple fixes. Better technology in the helmet, better technology in the pads, a mouthpiece to help absorb the shock when your teeth and jaw slams together. All of that, all of these things can be done without having to penalize anyone. But even beyond that, there was at one point the question of, listen, do players want this? How do players view this? And I'm on record having said multiple times that players, active players, should be on the rule committee to talk about these changes. Goodell, I mean, and this is not the offseason to do it, perhaps, because of the labor problems, but Goodell and the NFLPA should pull in active, past, and, you know, all players from all walks of life to come in and talk about these rules. And I, you know, I bet you money that if you sit these guys down, it's not going to be some sort of like fisticuffs are going to break out. That most of these guys are reasonable guys. Even James Harrison, though he may be a flaming nut job, for the most part, I bet if you sat down and listened to his point, I bet he comes off as reasonable. Like, the press crap aside, but I bet sitting down and having an actual conversation where you listen to him, I'm betting he doesn't come off as quite the nutball that he does sometimes. But you need current players involved in this stuff. Because the player mentality is Wilkerson or Sue's mentality. And that is, I'm going to go out and play football, and I'm going to play it the way I want to play it. I'm not out to hurt anyone. This is a collision sport. People are going to get banged up. Yeah, you know, and there was a call on the Browns that hit on Vic. It was hard not to think it wasn't a little bit of home cooking. I don't think it was, but it was a ludicrous flag. The player, and I can't remember who the Cleveland Brown was, hit Vic. His head was up. His helmet did not make a contact with Vic. They said he launched. He didn't. It was just a ridiculous penalty. And it's just like that across the board. And I'm betting you a lot of players feel that way. That a lot of these penalties, even quarterbacks, to some extent are like, this is a little ridiculous. At this point, you can't touch a quarterback without running the risk of drawing a flag when it's not warranted. And I think, you know, again, this just brings up to me what I've been saying, which is, you need active players involved in this. I think you need retired players because I think you need that post-career perspective. I think you need doctors involved, and I think you need teams and coaches involved. But you need current players. They're the guys playing the game. Have them involved. All that said, you could bring it back around and say Mo Wilkerson was very foolish for what he did. It was a bad idea. But kind of wanted to bring it in to talk about the mentality of it. And overall point out, listen, you know, these players know what they're getting into, and they want to play a certain way. And I think that needs to be put under consideration. And I think that should be done sooner than later. So with that said, we're going to move on to our weekly feature, Tebow Watch. Remember, folks, Brett Favre is not around for you to kick around anymore. And we know that you need a week-by-week obsession to obsess over with your obsessions. And in this particular case, we've decided that Tim Football, a.k.a. Tim Tebow, a.k.a. the third-string quarterback of the Denver Broncos, is the guy who you should be obsessing about. Now, first of all, heartbreaking news is that Tim Tebow's formerly number one selling jersey has dropped all the way down to 15. It's horrifying, horrifying that a second or third string quarterback's jersey is now merely top 15, not top 5. Tebow got a lot of snaps last week against the Seattle Seahawks. That's 11 attempts, 6 complete passes, 93 yards. Ran the ball pretty well, 4 times for 25 yards, set up a game-winning score. But this was the perfect Tebow game. All right, it was also a very good indication of an Orton game. Orton, 16 of 23, 236 yards, a touchdown, but also an interception. Again, between the 20s, from 20 to 20, Kyle Orton's probably your guy. Once you hit that red zone, Kyle Orton is kind of shaky. Tim Tebow can get things done in the red zone. Unfortunately, he can't get to the red zone. You know, Tebow would make a great pass. He would make a good read. He'd scramble really well. And then he'd turn around and fumble the ball like he did against the Seahawks. Trying to extend the play, not securing the ball well enough. Bang, there goes the ball, loses the ball. You know, then he corrects that. Does a great job running the ball. And then a couple minutes later, he makes a throw you're not even sure what the hell he's throwing at. The guy is still a project. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I feel like I have to drive this home every week just because of the madness that I see on message boards and chat rooms on Twitter. I mean, really. This is a guy who needs more time. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm curious to see if someone's going to come sniffing around on Orton or Brady Quinn. Because there are some bad quarterbacks in this league. Miami's a complete disaster. The Miami Dolphins, and I said this on that Football Sickness podcast, I think they're going to be fourth in the AFC East, and I think it's going to be a debacle. Chad Henne's not the answer. Tony Sperano can talk it up all he wants. I'm not buying what he's pitching. It's not happening. I for 2 or 3 years was a huge Chad Henne booster. But last year was kind of the end point for me. He just isn't getting it done at an NFL level. He is not showing me the ability to play consistently well. And you have a team that the owner tried to replace the coach before the coach was fired, failed and came back and gave him a guilt extension. And then the coach tried to get rid of the quarterback and failed. And now is trying to prop up his quarterback. The Dolphins need a new quarterback. Denver has one. I don't understand why they're not coming locking. Oakland needs a new quarterback. I like Jason Campbell. He's not the answer there. Of course, Oakland doesn't have any more ammunition to make a trade for a guy like Orton or Quinn. And oh, by the way, they've got Terrell Pryor now. So, mystery solved. Terrell Pryor will be the quarterback for the Oakland Raiders after he serves his 5-game suspension. If he serves his 5-game suspension and doesn't protest it. I don't know. That I still say that Oakland Raiders supplemental draft pick was a little on the nose. Come on, Al. Now you're just getting predictable. I don't know. Maybe Pryor turns out to be a good quarterback, but there's a shot in the dark. But so there, the other thing is Denver probably wouldn't trade within the division. There are a lot of reasons that the Oakland wouldn't work. I just don't know why Miami hasn't come sniffing again for somebody. Maybe they're trying to suck for luck, but even they're going to try and win. No team is going to lose on purpose. It just doesn't happen. These guys are not wired that way. If you decide that's what you're going to do, you're going to get yourself hurt. The Seahawks are a team that I could see going after a guy like Wharton. I don't quite understand why they haven't. Tarvis Jackson is not the answer. Charlie Whitehurst has been playing better, but really, Charlie Whitehurst? I don't know, maybe it's just a matter of not having had a chance prior to the last year or two. Maybe, as someone proposed to me, I believe it was on Twitter, they know the offensive line is just so bad that Tarvis Jackson is kind of the sacrificial lamb, I guess is the best word for it. They're throwing him out there because they know that whoever's out there is probably going to get killed at some point, and they're trying to save Charlie Whitehurst for later. Whitehurst, 5 of 8, 53 against the Denver Broncos. Not great, not bad. So some things, before we get going, that I've seen in preseason overall. And of course, it is preseason, so there's only so much you could read into it. Like, I'm not going to crown, the Detroit Lions as Super Bowl champions based on their beating of the New England Patriots. But a few things that I've seen throughout the last few weeks that I wanted to share with you. Some of it you've heard if you've read some of my stuff. Some of it is new. So first of all, Carolina Panthers. If you really thought that Cam Newton was going to come in and change the fortunes of that franchise, please see my speech about how one player does not win an entire Super Bowl by himself 15 minutes prior in this podcast. Still, Newton, like all of the, and this is overall note for the quarterback class of 2011. And I've been saying this for months. Cam Newton, Blaine Gabbert, Jake Locker, Kaepernick, Ponder, and most especially Andy Dalton, projects, every single one of them. In another year, most of those guys wouldn't have sniffed the first round. And oh, by the way, harkening back to the Tebow thing, shouldn't have been in the first round. The expectations people have for Tebow is based on the fact that he was overdrafted. So was pretty much everybody in this class, but they didn't have a lot of options. But so Cam Newton is just doing what we expected him to. If you had higher expectations of him, I think you were kidding yourself. It's the same thing with Blaine Gabbert. Shouldn't shock you that he's struggling. Should maybe they give him a shot because they've seen what David Garrard can do and it's not win a Super Bowl? Maybe. But you know he's going to struggle. Andy Dalton, you know he's going to struggle. There's going to be some problems. That's not a great offense. It's going to get windy. He doesn't have a lot of arm strength. He's going to have problems driving the ball. All of these guys are projects. And this is going to be the roughest year for rookies, especially quarterbacks, that we've seen in years because of the lockout. So I think it's going to be a difficult rookie season for quarterbacks. And if your team is starting a rookie quarterback, just hang on. Wait through it. Because remember, and I don't think any of these guys is Peyton Manning, but remember, Peyton Manning had a pretty rough first season. So these guys can develop. Don't give up hope. Hang on for dear life. Still cheer these guys on. And don't be too hard on them, because it's not an easy thing to do to start as an NFL quarterback. Even less easy when you've missed out on most of the practice that everybody before you has had. Item number two, Cleveland Browns, not as bad as people think they are. I don't know if Montario Hardesty is going to be able to stay healthy, but if he can, him and Hillis are a great tandem on the ground. Colt McCoy, I am here to tell you, is the real deal, Holyfield. He is a solid quarterback. He has improved his arm strength in the offseason. I like a lot of what I see with him. He still has a long way to go before he's what you would call trustworthy. Be that as it may, two big portions of that offense are going to look good. The defense has still got issues, but it's playing more aggressively. I've liked what I've seen from them. And finally, the wide receivers. I think Greg Little is going to have, he's going to be a rookie who has an impact this very season. I think this is a guy, maybe not immediately week one, but is very, very, very quickly going to be a factor in the offense. Three catches for 23 yards against the Eagles. Not a great game, but I like what I've seen in his route running. I've liked what I've seen with his hands. I think he's going to be a factor. I don't know if Muhammad Massaquoi is going to be healthy enough to be a factor, but I think Massaquoi and Rubisky are also going to be able to feast once defenses take note of Little. But before that, Little's going to put up some good points. Cleveland Browns offense is not a horrible offense. They are in a terribly tough division, having to face the Baltimore Ravens defense and the Steelers defense. But that said, I think they are going to be a very solid team, and they're going to surprise people. Green Bay. I was asked on the radio, a good friend, Matt Levine, this Saturday, who my Super Bowl prediction people were. And not surprisingly, I guess for some people, as I said, I think the Jets are going to make it to the Super Bowl this year. I think the Packers are going to repeat in the Super Bowl. I don't know that, I'm not going to say that they're going to win, but this is a team that, while it still has holes and still has problems, is just damn good. And they've gotten a ton of injured players back. If Jermichael Finley, if Donald Driver, if these guys can stay healthy, if the defense can stay healthy, and the offensive line can just play average, this team is deadly. Aaron Rodgers and his no-huddle offense already look in midseason form. The biggest question mark is Ryan Grant, James Starks. How is that going to suss out? I think you're going to see a pretty even split, but I do think this is the last year with Ryan Grant in a Packers uni. I think James Starks, maybe with some Alex Green, is going to be the story for 2012. The Buffalo Bills, again, said this on the Football Sickness podcast, I think they're your third place AFC East team. They've done some interesting things bringing on people on defense. Stevie Johnson is going to continue to play well. His adjustment as a true wide receiver number one, maybe a little rough at times, but I do think the Bills are going to be able to get him the ball, and Fitzpatrick just looks solid. The only thing they're doing that I disagree with wholeheartedly is trying to make C.J. Spiller the primary back. It doesn't really matter if he's a starter or not, but ultimately, Spiller is not a guy who can carry the rock, you know, 15 times a game and stay healthy. Get Fred Jackson in there. Most underrated running back in the league, Fred Jackson. Powerful, fast, tough, gets no love from the Bills franchise, apparently. But Buffalo is another team that can make some interesting noise going into this season. On the downside of things, I think that Chicago is going to struggle this year. I think a lot of things broke right in 2010. They're not going to do it this year. I think Minnesota's in for some tough times. I think it's going to be a very long season for Percy Harvin, although Adrian Peterson, he's succeeded with crappy teams around him before. I think he could do so again. And Washington, I think, is going to be a pretty rough year for Washington as well. So, some things that I had in my rattling around in my brain for the last couple weeks, as we're coming to the end of the preseason and getting closer and closer to real football. Just kind of wanted to share them with you. I'll give you my thoughts on week one next week. Talk about some of the games that are worth taking extra note of. Maybe make a couple picks, some predictions. And of course, make sure that you're up to date on all the important news as you get ready to sit down on your recliner, pop open a beer, and watch some real NFL football. Kids, it's just around the corner. We have one more week of preseason, and then it's Christmas in September. With all the tailgating, barbecue, and overly expensive beer that stadiums can sell to you. Huzzah! And of course, we will be here at the Hard Count and at Cheesehead TV to make sure that you have all the news and all the information you need. Great takes from myself, Aaron Nagler, and Brian Caravu, and everyone else at Cheesehead TV. We have you covered not just for the Packers, but for the NFL and football in general. I want to thank everybody for coming by, as always, tonight. Thank you for downloading the podcast. Of course, Aaron and I would talk if nobody was listening, but it does mean a lot that we have crazy people like us who have been listening to us throughout this tumultuous off-season. And I want to thank you for being a part of the show. You can always catch my fantasy football stuff over at Football Guys, but I also wanted to announce that I'm going to be a lead writer over at Bleacher Report doing some fantasy content, as well as a couple of question and answer and who do I start columns throughout the week, and then essentially, I guess, a live blog on Sunday throughout all of the games. So you can stop by, go to the front page of Bleacher Report on a Sunday. From week 1 to week 17, I'll be giving you fantasy information and giving you my takes on what's going on as it goes on, and probably a little regular NFL news as well on top of it. And of course, as always, you can catch my writing at cheeseheadtv.com. I am an NFL analyst there, and you can read my From the Press Box articles Tuesday afternoon. And 10 Questions With, which I'm going to try and do the entire season every Thursday. And again, this week, it is Chris Hansen from the Raiders blog, where you can get some very good Oakland Raiders information. He's a good guy, Chris, and I'm looking forward to sharing what he had to say about the franchise and the AFC West this Thursday. So, without further ado, have an outstanding rest of the week. I will see you guys same bat time. Well, actually, different bat time. Regular bat time. Regular bat channel. You've been listening to The Hard Count. I'm Andrew Garda. See ya.
You've been listening to The Hard Count with Aaron Nagler and Andrew Garda.
Let's go again!
Word!